Warning, the podcast Under the Stairs is not safe for work. We'll feature movie spoilers and language which most listeners may find offensive. Brought to you in conjunction with Legion Podcast Network. Welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. Hi everyone and welcome to the podcast Under the Stairs. This is In Reverence, episode number 5. I'm your host Duncan McLeish and welcome to the show. Now if this is your first time checking out an In Reverence episode, you might not know what that actually means. In Reverence is a sub-series of shows that I do on Podcasts Under the Stairs that charts certain movies that I saw at certain points in my youth, adolescence and adulthood, which has shaped my love of horror cinema. The episodes tend to look a bit more at the plot of the movie, some themes that I pick away from the movie, as well as its impact on me. What did it do to shape my love of horror cinema? And today is quite an interesting one in that we will be taking our first look at an Asian horror movie. Now, I'm a big fan of Asian horror cinema, but it's not one that I talk about all that much on Podcasts Under the Stairs. The main reason behind it is there is just so many movies to discuss, and as a result of that, sometimes I opt for episodes that will attract guests more than anything. And to be honest with you, when compiling lists of movies to get guests on, the thing at the back of my head is maybe they're not a fan of Asian horror cinema. I mean, it is a very niche subgenre. It has hardcore fans, and I would like to say that I consider myself one of them. But their cinema in general can be seen at times as being slightly goofy, and as a result, people can shun unfairly a lot of the incredible work coming out on that part of the world. And it's so diverse as well. When I think about Western cinema, I do think that in a lot of ways, European horror cinema and Asian horror cinema have a kind of kindred spirit. I mean, if you look at the sort of horror that the UK is producing just now, which is on some level a kind of bastardised version of what is big in Hollywood, but there's also been an upturn in things like folk horror, specifically on the back of such great work by directors like Ben Wheatley. It's now having an impact where directors are starting to... in fact, when we think about one of the big ones this year is going to be Ghost Stories, and if you look at the cinematography from that one, it's very evident that, you know, the Wheatley effect is in full swing. But if you look at even the way our horror is portrayed on TV, something like The League of Gentlemen is in that way a kind of folk horror story as well, and its revival last year certainly rides on the back of an interest in that. But if you compare that to French horror cinema, German horror cinema, if you compare it to Spanish horror cinema, there are all different flavours. There's this kind of different tinge put on each of them, and Asian horror cinema is very much the same. There's huge differences between a Japanese horror film and a Chinese horror film or a South Korean revenge horror film. Now, these are not just purely language-based, it's the way the stories are told, the kind of the mythology that goes behind a told story is what makes them feel more unique. It's what gives them their own little spice, which makes them different viewing. Growing up, I had seen things like Kurineko. I don't even know when I saw Kurineko for the first time. I have an acute memory of that movie, so much so that as soon as Eureka put it out on Blu-ray in the UK, I had to own that movie. I must own that movie. And my knowledge of, in particular, Japanese horror cinema had been geared to more, well, towards more stuff along the lines of, you know, the kind of 60s output of horror cinema. And then beyond that point, my interest started to move towards things like Akira Kurosawa, And certainly the impact of his samurai movies. And that's kind of what I associated with Japanese cinema after that point. It wasn't until I started working in the video store that I did when I turned 18 that I was very much aware that the mood was starting to change, and it was off the back of the movie we're going to discuss on this episode later on. The Ring, aka Ringu, was the first Japanese horror movie I'd seen in the kind of modern era of filmmaking, and its impact on me was great, and my interest and my attention was fully placed on Japan after that point. And by God, was I shocked to my adult core. I can say, hand on heart, the most scares I've ever had as an adult have been from the Japanese horror output. Movies like Ringu, like Audition, Dark Water, Shutter. These movies got under my skin in a way which I didn't think horror movies could. And it wasn't until much later on, kind of mid-2000s, late 2000s, that I found a brand new love and appreciation for not only Asian horror cinema, but swung back towards European horror cinema with releases like Wreck and the new wave of French extremity, and movies like Martyrs and Frontiers, Inside. These movies shocked me to my very core, and made me, you know, even more a fan of the genre than I'd ever been. The next In Reverence We're Doing will actually be featuring one of those movies from the new wave of French extremity, but I would feel remiss in my journey if we didn't tackle a bit of Japanese horror. As always at the start of these episodes, there is a bit of housekeeping, and whilst I've went on a little preamble at the start here setting up today's In Reverence, I do want to say that originally planned and scheduled for release today was the first of a three-part instalment looking at the Maniac Cop trilogy with my good buddy Andy Blockley. Andy unfortunately couldn't make the recording over the weekend, so we're postponing that to next Monday. So a week today, you will get myself and Andy Blockley reviewing Maniac Cop. And in the interim, this Thursday coming, you'll get a bonus episode with myself and the sexy, sexy Baz. And we're going to sit down and we are going to discuss a little Netflix movie that I talked about as part of my Fright Fest recap. And that is called Ravenous, not to be confused with the cannibal movie starring Robert Carlyle. This is Ravenous from 2017, released on Netflix just a couple of weeks ago. So if you want to make sure we don't spoil that movie too much for you, check out Netflix and return on Thursday to hear us talk about that. But I'm going to take my very first break of this episode. You are going to hear promos for shows that I love. You're then going to hear the trailer for the feature movie review of this In Reverence. We are discussing, Ring, aka Ringu, from 1998, 20 years old this year. Holy fucking shit. All that and more coming up right after this.
Bad movies. The world is full of them. From low-budget crap fests to downright unwatchable, and only two men are willing to watch them all. So climb in and take your seat. This is Short Bus Cinema.
Let's do it.
Hey everyone, this is Johnny Krug from Kruger Nation.
And this is Rick Morgan from the Helming Power Hour.
We have decided to team up and take you where no one has gone before.
We're on a quest to find the world's worst movie, and we're doing it on the bus.
Driving through cult classics in every genre to find the holy grail of bad movies.
So if you're looking for something different and more fun than you can stand, then climb on in.
Short Bus Cinema is a proud member of Legion Podcasts.
That's right, yo!
Short Bus Cinema. We'd love to watch the movies you hate.
Mm-hmm.
and welcome back. So you've just heard the trailer for this feature movie review of In Reverence. We're looking at Hideo Nakata's Ringu from 1998. Now, when this movie came out, I did say there was going to be a bit of a backstory. I was working in a video store. So this would be circa 2001-ish. I was very much aware that this video, this VHS, was on the shop floor, of which we had one copy of. The reason I was aware of it is that we had, within a year, not only a sequel, Ring 2, but we also had a prequel, Ring 0. And the shop that I worked in was very close to a university, which had a film course. So film students were regularly in and out of my video store. And I was forever hearing stories specifically about filming techniques. And film students generally think that if you work in a movie store, that you are super interested in movies. In the case of me, I was, but not necessarily from an academic point of view. I just had a love of cinema. I was a cinephile. What I remember most was disregarding quite a lot of the conversations that people had with me in the store. It was usually, you know, I love the way that this camera setup's done in this particular scene. Isn't Quentin Tarantino the greatest movie maker of our generation? That Tarantino dialogue really pops. Kevin Smith, Clerks, you know, when I saw that movie, it made me want to pick up a camera and take this course. And I mean, these people are not wrong, you know. Clerks is an amazing movie, and certainly Tarantino remains one of the prominent voices in modern movie making. But my love always kind of went to the macabre, the dark, the sinister, the horror. And as such, I just really wasn't interested, but I was very much aware that this movie, Ring, kept getting mentioned in conversation all the time. People would rent it out almost on a continual cycle. The movie was very seldom in the shop for more than a day before it was back out, and this pattern continued and continued. And when the sequel and prequel came in, you know, the two movies or three movies would be rented out in group by groups for people to go away, and they would come back and they would talk about it without spoiling the movie, back in the days before internet movie spoilers. Such a good time. But The Ring was constantly mentioned. Have you seen this movie? Was the question that I would be asked. And the answer was no. Yeah, I haven't seen it yet. I haven't had a chance. I was still binging on the fact that the UK had relaxed certain laws on video nasties. And I was getting my fill of Cannibal Ferox, I Spit in Your Grave, Island of Death. You know, these movies that had been banned for 20 plus years had finally been put in a position that it could be released uncut, or pretty much uncut, on VHS in the UK. And that was where my excitement lay. I'd grown up as a kind of younger teenager watching a lot of video nasties on bootleg VHSs, thanks to my older brother, and seeing some proper degraded horror. Not the subject matter, which is kind of degraded, but the actual quality. And the excitement of being able to see these movies on VHS, mostly due to Vipco putting them out, was the excitement for me. That's where my attention was drawn. But, you know, they kept talking about a Japanese horror movie and Ring, and you need to see this. So one night, I hired all three movies and took them home. And instead of watching them in release order, I decided to watch them in story, you know, kind of chronological order, which started with Ring Zero. A movie that I'm actually not much a fan of. I think it is, in principle, it falls into a couple of traps that I find with certain genre cinema in Japan, and that there is a huge degree of whimsy and kind of teenage romance that kind of percolates through it, which is cool, you know, that kind of works. But I was strapped and ready to be shocked to my very core, and this movie didn't really do it. It certainly set up the backstory for Sadako, but it didn't give me the thrills that I wanted. It didn't make me scared in the way that customers had told me I would be when I watched the movie. So coming off the back of that one, about 1 in the morning, I put in Ringu. Pretty much safe in the knowledge that this is the tone, this is going to have next to no effect on me. It's like watching a live action anime, which I was a fan of at the time. You know, that there's nothing in here that's going to shock me. And from about 5 minutes into this movie, my skin crawled. I was very much aware that I was sitting in a dark room. I was very much aware that I was by myself. I was very much aware that I hadn't really ever seen anything like this before, and immediate comparisons to something like the Blair Witch Project was front and foremost in my mind. It was an uncomfortable watch for me, to say the least, until it hit a certain point in the movie. And I know that if you've never seen Ringu before, this will be a spoiler, but we spoil movies on podcasts Under the Stairs. The end of this movie, when Sadako crawled out of the TV screen, fucking terrified me. I mean, absolutely terrified me. I had never seen anything like this in my life. So much so, I remember thinking that when I was a kid and I watched Poltergeist, that scene with the TV freaked me out then, and I thought how much of a pussy I was back then, because this was true terror. When she started crawling out the telly, I switched the movie off and switched my light on and chilled out for 5 minutes. And you might be thinking, Duncan's just trying to add dramatic effect here. No, I legitimately switched my TV off, switched the light on and chilled before I went back to watch the rest of this movie. It was one of the most powerful shocks I'd ever seen in a movie. And when I think about it now, I mean, when I watch the movie like I did for this run up here, I still get chills. I don't get scared, but I still get chills just by how iconic that scene is now. How it regularly makes the top 10 lists of scary movie moments. I think it is genuinely a shocking scene. But when I think about what I would witness moving beyond that in movies like Inside or Wreck, maybe it's not as powerful as it was then for staying power. Wreck is still a movie that makes me jump, and Ring doesn't, but it captured my interest, it captured my attention, so much so that right after watching it, I watched the second one, which I think is a damn fine sequel, which I think people don't talk about enough, and then went from there to check out the novel by Koji Suzuki, which is also called Ringu, or The Ring, and found that that book itself is less horror and much more kind of murder mystery. To be honest with you, it, in a lot of respects, is more like a supernatural giallo than anything else. But I was enthralled by the movie. Hideo Nakata has quite an interesting career. For all intents and purposes, The Ring was his first full feature-length directorial debut. He'd done a couple of shorts before this, but this was his kind of swan song, you know, into cinema, his make or break. And I think it shows. I think there's something very young, fresh and invigorating about this movie. A movie that combines kind of folklore. You think of things like Onibaba and Kuroneko that I mentioned earlier on. The kind of traditional spirit stories and, you know, their rich history in theatre with their plays with no masks. But he manages to on some level, connect it with kind of teenage Western horror movies. I don't know quite how the marriage works, but it really does in this movie. And you think of movies that were doing the rounds circa 1998, you were already getting that you know, we're coming off the back of Scream, off the back of I Know What You Did Last Summer, but also off the back of things like Urban Legend. And that's kind of where this movie exists, in this kind of Japanese folklore urban legend, which mixes kind of almost Western teenage teen horror movie kind of ideals, but at the same time the best of the kind of spirit world of Japanese cinema. And then you throw on top of that a fear, a general fear of things like technology, which was a big concern and remains a big concern nowadays as well, but certainly in the pace of the technological speed of how things were done in Japan, and the fact that they had this very vibrant, booming VHS kind of system in Japan. A lot of directors just made straight to VHS movies. When we think of people like Takashi Miike, he's no stranger to that. That's where he started off. But you know, in the case of this one, The Ring comes out as this amalgamation, this kind of hodgepodge, this melting pot of lots of different ideas. But what it manages to do is, and I mean, even we can throw Blair Witch into that as well, there's this kind of feeling of something new, this movement that might happen on the back of this movie, this creation of this almost pulp pop icon in Sadako, who, having been across to Japan, it's amazing how much merchandise Sadako actually has over there, she has loads. You can buy almost as much as her stuff as you can buy Jason masks over here. Just, you know, this iconic character in cinema, who even a couple of years ago had like a crossover movie with Kayako from The Grudge, which is another massive franchise. You could argue that a movie like Ju on The Grudge doesn't exist without the popularity of movies like The Ring, which, I think that's fair to say that in its assessment. But yeah, I mean, he had this career which started off so powerful with Ring, would ultimately make Ring 2 in Japan, and would actually go on to make Dark Water, which I think is an incredible bit of Asian horror cinema, which will get covered at some point as part of a, you know, standalone review, or maybe even an irreverence, because I genuinely think I watched Dark Water and it creeped me the fuck out as well. Such a beautiful movie to look at. But, you know, he went across to America. He did the sequel to the remake of The Ring, which is The Ring 2, which is not a great movie. He's done a bit on, you know, the anime adaptations, whether it's working within the Death Note franchise. I think he did L Change the World, the kind of Death Note movie, and is continually working on. He's got a movie out this year called Life in Overtime, and certainly the last movie that he put out, which I did get a chance to see a few years ago now, but was called Ghost Theater. The movie was kind of sold as a remake of one of Nakata's previous works from like the early to mid 90s called Don't Look Up. I've seen both movies, and to be honest with you, I don't know where the comparison comes in terms of a remake. I don't think it is, but, you know, each to their own. I'm fairly sure it did the movie quite well to be sold that way, but, you know, like I say, I don't think it is at all. But that brings us back to our conversation of looking at the movie The Ring. Now, Hideo Nakata takes the novel done by Koji Suzuki, and then kind of creates this new wave of, I mean, him and Miike are really the two guys with whom you would not have this massive interest from the West in Asian horror cinema. I mean, both these movies were huge hits. The Ring itself, though, became, I believe at the time, was the highest grossing horror movie in Japan of all time. I don't know if that record still exists. I probably err on the side of it probably still is. It was very much like the Blair Witch Project in the West, in that, you know, audiences went rabid for it. And the idea of the way not only the film was marketed, but the idea of how the curse was passed on in the movie was just this great way to do things. I mean, there was a certain, as a viewer, there was a certain perverse joy watching a movie about a cursed VHS tape while watching the movie on a VHS tape. I think that was quite incredible and very smart in the way they set things out. The movie itself is a kind of mystery. It's about a cursed videotape, which is being passed around from person to person. The curse is that when you watch the video, you receive a telephone call which will tell you that you will die within 7 days. At the end of those 7 days, you are visited by Sadako, who comes to take your soul, kill you. It's never really clearly identified. What is identified is what you look like after she visits you, and it's fucking terrifying. On top of that, we have this, there are other aspects peppered along which I think are really cool. If you have watched the video, if you have your photograph taken, your face appears warped. It's part of the curse. You're kind of distorted, phased out almost in the face, which is quite unsettling to look at as well. This reporter, investigator, and her, it's never, I don't think it is her husband, but it certainly was her partner, they're estranged, start investigating in to the origins of this videotape after both watching it, to see if they can get to the bottom of the curse in time to break it before they are visited by Sadako. To add to the tension, they have a child together who also watches the movie, and then this adds this extra level of stress on them to get to the bottom of it. They believe that when they watch the videotape, which is a series of jumbled up images which don't make sense, even the camera angle in certain circumstances doesn't make sense compared to where mirrors are in the kind of foreground. They should pick up someone holding the camera. It's almost like someone has beamed their very thoughts onto this videotape, and what we get is this investigation by these two adults, and to try piece together the symbolism behind each of the frames in the video as a way to unlock the mystery in time. What I kind of love about this movie, what really stuck with me, and it actually, I would credit this movie amongst a few others which will appear in reverence, as really growing my appreciation for a kind of a tense, slow-burning way of telling a story. Ringu has no real jump scares at all, doesn't really have much in the way of a score running through it. Sim design is kept very minimal, very quiet. There is no gore in this movie at all. All things that people associate with horror movies. You think about how people describe a horror movie today, it's usually, well, it's jump scares, or it's music being played really loud to get a jump scare, and look at the bloods everywhere, and, you know, quick cuts and pacing. You think about this movie coming out 2 years after a movie like Scream, which was sharp, snappy, to the point, witty, you know, self-referential to the horror genre. It was, you know, it was a cool horror kid in movie form for the MTV generation of quick edits and cuts and all the rest. You know, within 2 years, The Ring is basically holding up two middle fingers at that movie, saying that's not how you do horror. How you do horror is through tension. You build the story up in layers, you know, each layer being this slightly more sinister, slightly creepier layer on top of them, till you have this structure, this temple of terror. And that's what they do in this movie. The characters are all fully realised. I think that's wonderful. There's an almost shot for TV feel for this as well. If you think about how polished movies looked in 1998, this is not looking all that polished. It comes out the same year as Blair Witch Project. It comes out the same year as The Last Broadcast. It's tackling kind of similar sort of similar sort of groundbreaking ideas in the way we put forward horror ideas, but it's doing it very, very, very differently than those two movies. Actually, in a lot of respects, is more similar to something like The Last Broadcast than it is a Blair Witch Project, but they feel like their own little mini empires of how to tell stories, how to tell horror cinema. There's a lot of subtext to do with Japanese culture, and I would recommend anyone that is interested in Asian horror cinema and, you know, digging a bit deeper beneath the surface of subtext in a lot of these movies, that you check out a show on Legion Podcast Network called The Hero Hero Ghost Show. My good buddy Bo Ransdell hosts that, and it's been running for 3 seasons now, where he looks at not only Japanese horror movies, but he looks at Asian horror cinema with a bit of a microscope, and you get a bit of detail about filmmakers, casting characters, and stories behind the films themselves. And I would certainly, if you're more interested in how the cultural aspects of how, you know, that civilization has grown up and what they still believe in today, you know, kind of 20th century or 21st century Japan looks at their cinema, then that's the place to go. Go to Hero Hero Go Show and check out the fantastic work. I've been over there. I did a show with him on Audition, and I think I've been back for at least, it was either Onibaba or it was Kuroneko. I think it was Kuroneko I did, but yeah, tons of stuff over there with that one, and it's available through Legion Podcast Network, legionpodcast.com, Hero Hero Go Show. But yeah, there's tons of social commentary going on here as well. About, you know, about technology, about youth, about the old meets the new, the kind of historical elements of Japanese folklore and sinister storytelling about spirits melded with technology, the aspect that these things can be passed along in a cursed videotape. And ultimately, the way to break the curse being found as a way of, you have to make a copy and then show it to someone, so the curse continues on forever. You know, it's infinitum. Forever, this curse will be carried on. And the setup to the very end of the story of how to save her child, she will show the tape to her parents, or parent, get them to watch it, and it's never really expressed out at the end of that movie whether or not she's going to tell that parent how to pass it on, or whether she's just going to leave her parent to die at the hands of Sadako in order to save her child. I love the movie as well in that it has this, like I was saying, it builds up all these layers, but what it does beautifully is the kind of false setup of the end of the movie and the reveal, which you think, for all intents and purposes, is we've managed to make it here just in time. It's the Hollywood ending that it rebels against, which I kind of love. It sets up this ending that the curse has been stopped just in time, and they'll be fine, and everything's going to be great. And right enough, the lead female reporter, she survives past that date, so everything's going to be great. And then her estranged partner is visited by Sadako, and what I mentioned earlier on is a genuinely one of the greatest moments in horror cinema. I put it right up there with the kind of the Here's Johnny from The Shining, the scenes from The Thing, you know, just like the creepiest moments in horror cinema, you know, Sadako crawling at the telly is right there, right in the middle, I think, of that one. It's become this massive kind of pop cult horror iconic scene. But he's you know, visited and left with a look of pure terror on his face when she finds him, which leads to this discovery of, what did I do different that he didn't do? And it was the making of the videotape. So there's this kind of twist at the very end, which I love. I think that's phenomenal. Love that in this movie. When I saw this movie for the first time, I was genuinely floored. I thought it was incredible. And I really do think that second movie holds up really, really well. I don't hate the American remake. Actually, the American remake is okay for the most part. They make some stylistic changes, which I understand is probable to make it compatible with Western audiences, but I think, you know, if you look at... It's weird, because I was going to say, if you look at how the sequel's handled by the same director as the original, and it's not a very good movie at all, where I look at something like Gion the Grudge versus The Grudge, which is the same director doing both movies, I actually think the Western version is better than the Japanese version in that scenario. But the American version's fine. I think it's a decent horror movie. I don't like the digital Samara, who kind of just disappears and appears right in front of them. There's something grotesquely beautiful and sinister about the weird ballet and disjointed movements that Sadako has when she comes out that well and through that TV. And also something just creepy about wells. They feature quite a lot in kind of Western folklore, and I'm not sure if they feature that much in Japanese, but there's something just... The idea of being locked in a well or being trapped down a well is something that we all kind of grow up with through, you know, stories your parents tell you, fairy tales. You know, I'm surprised Lassie hasn't been called because Timmy's fallen down the well. You know, it's we have that in the back of our head, and I think that just adds an extra layer of just weird creepiness on top of this. After seeing Ringu, it was not long until I saw Audition, which was another movie that genuinely just fucking floored me. And from there, I got really interested in things like Dark Water, Shutter in particular. And that's kind of carried on. I still have this real love for kind of Asian horror cinema. Certain directors, whether it's a Sion Sono or a Takashi Miike, Kurushi, Kurosawa, you know, the list goes on, and there's still some really exciting work coming out from over there, which just continues to trundle away. Very much like other areas in the world where you look at the new wave of French extremity, the kind of influx of Spanish horror we got towards the kind of late kind of 2007, 2008, 2009 era. Attention starts to dwindle, where the audiences start to seek out new things. That doesn't mean that the production of these movies don't keep happening. They do. They certainly keep trundling on. It's just there's not as much spotlight shone on them. And that's where, if you have an interest in these subgenres, you will continue to try and seek out the next big thing coming out from these areas and be excited as and when they drop. But from this, I found myself exploring other territories and kind of Asia for horror, and got on really quick with the Chan-wook Park train, you know, through his Vengeance trilogy or Thirsty, and things like Stoker, most recently Handmaiden, which is fucking phenomenal. But you know, Three Extremes was a great example of a movie that was born out of the interest of the attention of Western audiences, or even Eastern audiences, on horror cinema, that you could bring three directors from three different parts of Asia to each director short. And certainly go back and listen. I've discussed that recently on a movie club a couple of months ago. But the attention went that way, and my attention followed. It's a hugely influential movie on me. It's equally important to my growth as a horror fan away from European kind of video nasty genre stuff and American sort of slasher cinema as, you know, a Blair Witch Project, a Last Broadcast. Without my interest here, I would never have found Noroi the Curse. You know, it was an exciting time to be a genre fan, and yeah, The Ring is one of the cornerstones of my modern appreciation, my kind of adulthood appreciation of horror cinema. It's a pretty fucking incredible movie. If you have not seen it before, then I've maybe spoiled quite a bit. If you've not seen it in a while, don't jump right back to that American remake. It's a lazy way to watch that movie, and it hides a lot of the actual tension that Hideo Nakata actually does in the movie. Go back to the original, sit down, watch it in the fucking dark, and just watch a masterclass in tension and storytelling and real creepy grittiness in a movie. A movie that has no blood, has next to no jump scares, very little in the way of score, but is a creepy, unsettling watch, almost from start to finish, which I think, if anything, is the greatest accolade you can give to a horror movie, is one that doesn't use cheap gimmicks, but still manages to terrify. It's a phenomenal piece of cinema. Right, I'm going to take my final break of this show. When I come back, I'm closing it out right after this.
You're listening to the podcast Under the Stairs.
And you've been listening to the podcast Under the Stairs. This has been In Reverence episode number 5, looking at Hideo Nakata's 1998 horror movie Ring, aka Ringu. Hopefully you've enjoyed that one. That one is a movie that I deeply, deeply, deeply love. I am still waiting for an immaculate Blu-ray transfer. My fingers are crossed that Arrow has something in the works. The only reason I mention that, and it's something I forgot in my Fright Fest episode, is there was a dude up from Arrow there doing a bit of chatter, as you do, and had said that this year in particular, there are going to be some Tartan Asia releases making their way to Blu-ray. And for those that have a long memory like I do, they remember that they put out a lot of Asian cinema. And I want to say, I might be wrong, but I think Tartan Asia put out Ring. If I'm wrong about that one, then god damn it. But if I'm right, then I'm hoping. That's what I'm hoping for. Why that movie's not had the bells and whistles massive box set release. Put all three of them in there. Fuck it. I mean, put Ring Zero, Ring and Ring 2 in a box set, charge me £50 and I'll pay for it in a second. Give me it on sweet, sweet Blu-ray with lots of special features. I would love to add that movie to my collection. I think it might happen. Dark Water got a phenomenal release from Arrow, so you'd like to think, but who knows. But yeah, hopefully you go and check that movie out. And I look forward to the discussions, as always. It was fun hearing some people talk about checking out White of the Eye, which was the previous In Reverence episode. And I look forward to hearing this one. It's a bit more conventional. It's a bit more mainstream. It's not as if I'm breaking the walls down here and reinventing the circle by saying The Ring's a great horror movie. But hopefully it gives you a little insight into the movies that shaped my love of horror. Now, like I said at the start of this episode, we will return on Thursday with a bonus episode. Myself and the Baz reviewing Ravenous, the 2017 French-Canadian zombie horror flick currently available on Netflix. So go and check that movie out ahead of us dropping that episode. And then a week today, we'll be dropping Maniac Cop 1 review with myself and Andy Blockley. Tons of content coming your way, ladies and gents, in the month of March. Which brings me to say there's a multitude of ways to check out the podcast Under the Stairs. As always, I recommend you check us out through Apple Podcasts. Come across, subscribe to the feed, that way you get the episodes as and when they drop and access to the entire back catalogue of Teapot's content. There are so many episodes now, so yeah, subscribe, that way you get them all. You can also leave us a rating and a review over there. They are really important to our cause as a horror podcast. The ratings, 5 stars for example, the more of them we get, the higher up the iTunes charts are pushed for people to check out the show. And as always, those reviews are equally important. They tell people why you enjoy listening to the show and maybe why they might want to check out as well. It takes seconds for you to do it. It doesn't cost anything and it genuinely is the best way to support the podcast. It's been a wee while since we got one, so I'm kind of hoping some of the new listeners out there that are checking us out through Apple Podcasts will swing down and leave us a quick review. It does really help us. You can check us out at Stitcher Smart Radio, SoundCloud, TuneIn, as well as Google Play. Come and visit our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/TP. teapotscast. Go to our website, teapotscast.com. You can subscribe to our newsletter. There is a newsletter coming at the end of this week with a massive competition in there. So you need to be signed up to be entered in it. And there's no question, it's just providing me with a movie. That's all you have to do. And if it's picked out the hat and you win, then congratulations, you're going to win a horror block full of fucking awesome. That's right, full of awesome. That's what I'm going to put on the sheet for customs. What does this package contain? Well, it's full of awesome, and that's what they'll write. And hopefully you won't be charged by customs on the other side when it's opened and you realise that awesome actually means a lot of horror content. So yeah, come across to the website, sign up for the newsletter. Visit the Bads on the Twin Prongs of social media sexiness. You can check them out on Instagram and on Twitter, both at TeapotsCast. So, I hope you've enjoyed this impromptu In Reverence episode, kind of flung together at the last minute to cover the Maniac Cop episode, which will be coming a week today. I'm very excited about that one. Three episodes, three movies, each one progressively worse than the one before. Yeah, what can go wrong? Nothing can go wrong, ladies and gents. Nothing can go wrong. But wherever you are, whatever the time zone is, and whatever you're up to in this big, bad world of ours, please take care of yourselves. This is Duncan McLeish broadcasting live from under the stairs, and I'm signing off.